What's causing the epidemic of violence against women in Tijuana, Mexico?
Women are at higher risk of HIV. They are also at higher risk of assault through, you know, clients in sex work. They're also at higher risk of assault, sexual assault by police. And they're often, those that work in a sex trade are often servicing cartel members, narcos. And, you know, as I discovered all these different sources of vulnerability and danger, it struck me that, you know, the HIV epidemic is one thing, and it is very real in Tijuana. But it was only one aspect of a larger set of hazards facing women in the city.
That's epidemiologist Dan Werb. We talk with him about his powerful exploration into the causes of the epidemic of missing and murdered women in Tijuana, City of Omens. Then, just in time for a Global Week of Action on the climate, we air an excerpt from an interview with climate scientist Michael Mann. Mann is a member of the IPCC panel and the author of several books, including The Madhouse Effect with cartoonist Tom Tolles. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I've long wondered why so many women have gone missing in recent years on the Mexican side of the border. That's something that also puzzled my guest, epidemiologist Dan Werb. When he went to Tijuana to track the causes and incidence of HIV in the city, he found that it was just one piece of a much larger threat to the lives and health of women there. Already known as one of the most violent cities in Mexico, Tijuana has become increasingly dangerous for women. Over the past 10 years, the murder rate has skyrocketed, producing a staggering number of female victims. Dan Werb calls it an epidemic of femicide. His investigation into its causes revealed a complex web implicating the U.S.'s relationship to its southern border, our policies of immigration and deportation, corruption of the Mexican police and government, and the exploitation of women workers in the factories and brothels of Tijuana. City of Omens is a kind of scientific detective story that one reviewer called a riveting and heartbreaking story told with eloquence and compassion. Well, Dan Werb, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book, City of Omens, A Search for the Missing Women of the Borderlands, it is about a topic that I know has puzzled me for a very long time, the epidemic of murders of women in Mexico along the border. You focus on Tijuana, and you're an epidemiologist. So this story began with you going to Tijuana as part of a team to study HIV and injection drug use there. Tell us how you got involved in this.
Sure. So I'm Canadian, and I'm from Vancouver, Canada, which has the unhappy situation of being the first port of entry for heroin and other opioids that are trafficked from China and other countries around there and into Canada and then into the United States. So for that reason, among many others, Vancouver has become sort of this hub of injection drug use. And I initially started my training as an epidemiologist, which is basically, you know, a scientist that tracks epidemics across populations and tries to understand how they move. I started that work in Vancouver, in the city's downtown east side, which is sort of the injection drug use hub. And there I met some scientists who were working at the border. And when I finished up my PhD on the topic of how people transition into injection drug use, I got invited to do some work down at the border in Mexico. And the border work was essentially to track how a change in drug laws in Mexico might influence HIV risk among people who inject drugs. And among that population, women are always present and are often both injecting drugs while also participating in the sex trade in Tijuana.
So change in the drug laws, what happened?
So, I mean, it's a really interesting phenomenon. Mexico in 2009 passed one of the world's most progressive drug policies, modeled on a drug policy that had been passed in Portugal in 2001, which decriminalized all drug use. So if anyone, and this law is still on the books in Mexico, if anyone in principle is found with drugs on them under a certain quantity threshold, they are not to be arrested and charged. They are instead meant to be diverted to treatment if need be, and then have be supported in managing their own substance use issues. So that was basically the impetus for me to come down to Tijuana to see how this radical drug law from what was really intense police-focused sort of prohibition into this progressive public health-oriented system, how that would influence HIV risk. And the thinking was, well, it would probably decrease the risk that people would share syringes because they were afraid of police, would be unwilling to access services, again, because they'd be afraid to be identified as people who are using drugs, and instead, you know, access clean syringes, access health services, and thereby have their risk of acquiring or transmitting HIV reduced. Now, the strange thing is that after this law was passed, it was essentially forgotten. So despite having this really progressive law on the books, where all drugs are decriminalized, it's essentially been business as usual in Mexico. And there was basically no change in the level of policing brutality against people who inject drugs, and again, women, in Tijuana and really across Mexico after this law was passed. And by some statistics, we actually saw an increase in the targeting of people who inject drugs, including women, in Tijuana after this law was passed, which is really quite strange.
Yeah. To what do you ascribe this failure, utter failure, to enforce this law?
Part of it was just political will. Looking back on it, this very enlightened approach to handling drugs and substance use and addiction, I think was actually motivated by a desire to free up resources at the federal level in Mexico to intensify the fight, the military fight against cartels in that country. And, you know, there was also basically none of the infrastructure to allow for a system predicated on effective treatment of substance use to emerge in Mexico, because that system just didn't exist. In Tijuana, there is no functioning treatment system for addiction. There are a series of relatively sketchy and sometimes bordering on sort of torturous centers for addiction treatment that, you know, just force people to do cold turkey, that sometimes send people who are in quote-unquote recovery out into the street to panhandle to collect money that is then given to the staff to pay for their stays at these centers. One person that was interviewed in Tijuana who had an experience at a treatment center described actually being forced to work at Walmart in Tijuana and have their wages directly paid to staff at one of these treatment centers. So, you know, this is a brutal system that really is not interested in the rights of people who use drugs, who were recovering from addiction. And it was just business as usual. And on the street, that meant that the kind of policing that has been a feature of Tijuana, which is, again, really focused on extortion and physical and sexual assault of people who use drugs, and particularly of women who are in the sex trade, just continued unabated.
Yeah, so you went to study the HIV epidemic and injection drug use, but you ended up studying the mass murder of women. How did that happen?
So I came down there, I came to Tijuana, and it was abundantly clear to me immediately that, you know, in my field visits, you know, maybe I'll just start at day one, which I describe in the book. I arrived in Tijuana and I was brought to the Tijuana River Canal, which is a large sort of cement open air canal that was produced to stop Tijuana from flooding. There's a large estuary that runs out from Tijuana and then across the border into San Diego and then out into the sea. And the Tijuana River Canal was built to stop flooding. And, you know, nowadays it's mostly just a trickle of polluted water that runs through the middle of it because the area is quite dry, except for occasional flooding where, you know, you get these torrential desert rains where it's like the whole like topography of the place gets picked up and thrown into the ocean by these torrential rains. So I visited the canal because that's where, by all accounts, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people who were injecting drugs and living basically in these open air enclosures made out of mud and, you know, wooden beams and just essentially garbage and detritus. Not the vast majority, but about 40% of the people in these camps are thought to be deportees from the United States. And, you know, this population living in the canal injecting drugs is replenished daily by the ongoing deportation of people from the United States and into Tijuana, which peaked at over 300 people per day in the later Obama years and is still over 100 people per day deported to Tijuana. So it's a really dynamic population, a population that, you know, essentially arrives with nothing, many of whom have never been to Tijuana, some of whom have never even, you know, don't even speak Spanish because they've been in the United States for so long, brought there as children. And when I arrived in these camps in the canal, I really expected to see, you know, a mix of men and women. More men, sure, but at least some women. And in the camp that I arrived at, which was about 40 or so people, there was only one woman present. And that struck me initially because, you know, that's rare. There's generally a minority of women in sort of like homeless encampments in any setting. But the fact that there was really only one woman there, it felt a bit chilling, honestly. And I wasn't sure why, but as I learn more about the city and the situation of women, you know, women are at higher risk of HIV. They are also at higher risk of assault through, you know, clients in sex work. They're also at higher risk of assault, sexual assault by police. And they're often those that work in a sex trade are often servicing cartel members, narcos. And, you know, as I discovered all these different sources of vulnerability and danger, it struck me that, you know, the HIV epidemic is one thing, and it is very real in Tijuana. But it was only one aspect of a larger set of hazards facing women in the city.
Well, before we go on, I just kind of want to go back to one thing you said, which is just a bit of a digression, but you said this is during the Obama administration, 300 deportees a day, now half that, which I think is surprising. And also, are these people being deported because they're addicts? I mean, you know, in other words, you know, Trump says, you know, they're all, you know, drug dealing criminals, right? So just try to clarify that, and then I want to come back to the narrative.
Yeah, you know, their statistics vary, but by all accounts, the later years of the Obama administration were high points historically for the deportation of people from the United States and into Mexico. And I really want to, you know, emphasize the point that many of these people were brought as children, right? And people who are detained across California and a few other states, or deported from California and a few other states, are sent to Tijuana despite, you know, regardless of whether they'd ever been there or not. So people arrive with essentially nothing in a dangerous and chaotic city, and they're forced to make do. And you cross the border, and the first thing you see is the Tijuana River Canal and the encampments therein. And, you know, that is magnetic for some people who have nothing and who are just looking for a place to hide and collect their thoughts and themselves. Now, in terms of why people are deported, it varies. You know, in some cases, it's overzealous local enforcement agencies. Absolutely, it is not that people are necessarily using drugs. That is simply just people can be deported for a variety of reasons. I've heard very credible stories of people having taillights out and being pulled over, and then they're discovered to be undocumented, and then they are deported within 36 hours after having lived in the United States for decades. Or someone who was deported after driving with their friend along a highway and taking the wrong turn, accidentally driving up to a military base, which was restricted. And at the front of this military base, this friend was discovered not to have papers and was deported. So, you know, these are tiny infractions. And, you know, there's a variety of reasons why people are deported. But I think the prevailing motivation is really just arbitrary and really about the zealousness with which, you know, individual agents seek to punish people.
So let's go back to this story, Dan Werb, City of Omens, A Search for the Missing Women of the Borderlands. This book is like a detective story, only using epidemiological science to follow the clues in the search for the missing women of Tijuana. And it's really a fascinating look at how epidemiology can solve health and social mysteries. So before we go deeper in, just give us a brief explanation of what epidemiology is.
Yeah, so epidemiology is the study of epidemics. So it's a real world science, not done in a laboratory. It's a science that seeks to understand why epidemics, and you know, you can define an epidemic really broadly as sort of any health condition, why any health condition might be spreading across a population. And the key here is the epidemiologic triad that's made up of the pathogen, the host, and the environment. And it's the interplay between these three phenomena that determine how and whether an epidemic is going to spread. So a host is the organism that's affected by the epidemic. The pathogen is that which carries the epidemic. It spreads it. So, you know, think about a HIV virus is a pathogen. And in that case, the host would be human beings. And then the environment is exactly that. It's sort of the setting in which all of the action occurs, in which all the kind of engagement between the host and the pathogen takes place. And generally, epidemics can be traced back to a change in one of these three features. So it's either the environment changes. So, you know, maybe humans move into a new environment, and there they encounter new pathogens that infect them and spread into an epidemic. Or it's the host that changes. Maybe you've got a bacterium that suddenly becomes multi-drug resistant, and then you've got a new epidemic. Or maybe it's a change in the host themselves. Maybe there's a certain vulnerability that creeps into the makeup of that organism that makes them suddenly vulnerable to a host that's been there all along. And so, you know, in a way, it's very simple. It's just these three features that you're trying to understand, you know, on their own and in relation to each other. But of course, in the real world, when you apply it and try to take into account all the many factors and variation that we encounter daily in our complex lives, that's where it becomes a truly remarkable science and a challenging one.
Yeah. So you create an epidemiological investigation into the murders of women in Tijuana, and you start with the pathogen. What is the pathogen?
Yeah. And that, you know, that is exactly the question that I was asking myself throughout the many years that I was working on this book. So I started working in Tijuana in 2013. And as I mentioned, it struck me that HIV appeared to be only one of the many hazards facing women in the city, particularly women working in the sex trade, migrant women who had potentially come to Tijuana to seek jobs in the maquiladora or manufacturing sector. And while there seemed to be sort of this obtuse relationship between HIV and, say, assault and murder by a cartel member, or even car crashes or overdose, I couldn't shake the feeling that there was a larger meta-epidemic behind all of these various epidemics that I could track. And understanding that larger epidemic and understanding what was behind it was the work of the book. And what I describe in the book is essentially a social pathogen that drives all of these other epidemics and which lurks in the very fabric of the city. And I think importantly for readers of the book in the United States, is actually motivated in many ways and intensified by the way in which the United States manages its borders and its relationship with Mexico, and particularly the people of Mexico and, you know, Americans living in this sort of binational borderland.
Right. And it is within that relationship that you ultimately find the key to solving this detective story. First of all, give us a sense of the scope of the epidemic of femicide, as you call it. How many women are found dead in the city every year in Tijuana?
So it varies. And, you know, what struck me about this, and really it did feel like a murder mystery at times, but one that's being played out sort of at the level of a city or a region. In 1990, San Diego, which is separated from Tijuana by the border, but is essentially contiguous with it, San Diego and Tijuana had the same murder rate. They both had murder rates of about 10 per 100,000, which is high, but, you know, not radically so. Since 1990, in the following decades, the murder rate in San Diego dropped quite steadily, and now it's around 2 per 100,000. And last year, the FBI declared that San Diego is the safest big city in America. Now, right across the border, steps away, Tijuana has seen this remarkable and disturbing increase in the murder rate, to the point that while the murder rate in San Diego was 2 per 100,000 last year in 2018, the murder rate in Tijuana was 125 per 100,000, making it, by some calculations, the most dangerous city in the entire world. Now, what's disturbing about that, in and of itself, it's horrific. But what's disturbing is that there has also been a steady increase in the proportion and number of women who are killed in Tijuana and in the greater state of Baja California, in which Tijuana is located. So in a recent year, there were over 1,000 women who were either murdered or disappeared. And in Tijuana, in one year, there were 300 women murdered or disappeared. And more recently, statistics sort of vary because there are no reliable statistics, or I have been warned by Mexican colleagues not to trust the official statistics in Mexico because they're often unreliable, or they're, I wouldn't say tampered with, but essentially they don't reflect the scope of the harms that women are facing. But certainly it's in the hundreds. And this is a city of, you know, 1.6 to 1.7 million people. So it's not a very large city. And as I mentioned, you know, what was doubly disturbing and what really motivated the book is that, you know, this wasn't a static situation. It's not that the overall numbers of people murdered in the city increased and the proportions between men and women who were killed stayed the same. It was that the overall numbers have increased, but the proportion of women was also increasing. And that, to me, you know, that is an epidemic. And that was something that I felt like I needed to understand.
So the border, this is the environment. You know, we talked about the epidemiological triad of host, pathogen, environment. The environment is the borderland. You've talked about the canal near the border in Tijuana. Talk about the relationship between the two sides of the border, which you've already begun to talk about by contrasting the murder rate. But there's actually a relationship between them. So tell us what that is.
Sure. I mean, like any two places that are right next to each other, there are a variety of relationships, too many to name, you know, like so many of the people who live along the border on both sides, and not only in San Diego and Tijuana, but across the whole southern, the U.S.-Mexico border. There's relationships, there's family relationships between both sides. There's people who are, you know, in intimate relationships with each other. And there's this constant cross-border trade. So in California, it's estimated that Tijuana and San Diego and its regions collectively produce about $6 billion in goods every year. So this isn't, you know, that one side produces goods and it's shipped to the other. It's that goods are assembled using resources on both sides. And the assembly and production of those goods could only happen with both sides working. There is this long-standing relationship, and really the whole reason why there's a large red light district and sex trade in Tijuana, it's related to the fact that there is one of the largest naval bases in the continental United States located in San Diego, just about 20 minutes up the highway from the border. And as research from the U.S. military itself has concluded, any time that you station military personnel in a place, you will create a local sex trade. And that's exactly what's happened over decades and decades in Tijuana and San Diego. You've had a really steady and reliable source of income for women working in the sex trade in Tijuana as a result of the 100,000 or so military personnel that work in San Diego and take shore leave in Tijuana. And then there's just the natural relationships between the places. And by that, I mean, you know, the environment itself. As I described, the Tijuana River Canal runs from Tijuana, which is geographically higher than San Diego. So water runs down these canals, these canyons, into the Tijuana River Canal and then across the border into San Diego and into the sea. And there's this strange cyclical relationship that's described in the book around tires, of all things, where, you know, California is a car-obsessed state, and California drivers burn through about 40 million tires per year. And millions of those tires are sent to Tijuana because it is cheaper to send them into Mexico, where they can be disposed of cheaply. It's cheaper to do that than to dispose of them in sort of by the standards of the state of California. So this cross-border trade in used tires is worth about $150 million per year. Of course, that means that Tijuana is just absolutely littered with tires. In every crevice, there's whole neighborhoods, and this is not hyperbole, there are whole neighborhoods, the foundation of which are built on tires. So you've got houses that have built walls out of tires that sit on tires filled with concrete and sand. And you know, it's essentially like a natural resource there. Of course, tires are also, you know, there's loose tires everywhere. And as I described, there are torrential rains that flow every few times a year. And these rains can lift up millions of tires and send them hurtling through the Tijuana River Canal, where people use drugs and live and are sometimes drowned during these torrential rains. And then these tires, and often bodies as well, are found across the border in San Diego on beaches and canyons there. So there's all these different overlapping and super complex relationships between the two sides, because, you know, ultimately the only thing that makes this place a binary is the border wall. In all other respects, you know, the borderland is one place. It's multidimensional. It's just a place complicated by a border that seeks to separate something that is really coherent in and of itself.
Dan Werb. We'll talk more with him about his book, City of Omens, A Search for the Missing Women of the Borderlands, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Let's continue with my conversation with epidemiologist Dan Werb about his riveting book, City of Omens. It's an inquiry into the causes behind the epidemic of murdered and missing women in Tijuana, Mexico. You're describing an environment across several different factors. One is the sex trade. One is the environmental interrelationship here. You've talked about the factories, the maquiladores, although we didn't use that term, which also are involved with huge amounts of environmental toxicity, environmental pollution. I mean, I can remember the scandals of children being born to mothers who worked in the maquiladoras who had anencephaly. They were born with very, very small or practically no brains, which is related back to the environmental toxins. So talk about that aspect of this environment and how that impacts the health of women in this area.
Yeah, so the maquiladoras, they employ about 200,000 people in Tijuana. There's around 600 or 700 of these factories, and they are major factories. They're really heavy duty, and you know, these are multinational companies that have established a footprint in Tijuana because of its favorable free trade laws, as well as its ready and essentially immediate access to the United States market. So you've got maquiladoras here that produce, you know, almost every pacemaker that Americans have in their chests, or 75% of the plasma TVs that Americans consume. Foxconn, the maker of Apple products like iPhones, is there. There's aerospace companies. There's all kinds of companies. And essentially what these companies do is they will produce these factories, and then they will create little bespoke communities underneath them. Often, you know, or if not create them, allow these slums, essentially favelas, to generate themselves under the canyons upon which the maquiladoras sit. This is a huge economic driver for Tijuana and really for the region, the cross-border region. And it's also a major pull for migrant women seeking work. As I mentioned, the majority of women who work in, or the majority of people who work in maquiladoras are women. But they also, as you describe, produce lots of pollution and toxicity, and they essentially end up killing women either through passive pollution or through dangerous working conditions. And, you know, I think that's a major aspect of why women come to Tijuana, and I think is one of the kind of component causes, to use an epidemiologic term, of the larger epidemic that I was tracking, this epidemic of femicide in Tijuana. And, you know, it also, this economic driver is an illusion for some. So some women will come to the city and they won't be able to find work in the maquiladoras. And then they are at risk of entering the sex trade or the drug trade. And that's, you know, lots of the focus of the book is on specific women and following the stories and understanding and hearing the narratives of women who have lived in Tijuana for decades, who work in the sex trade, who often came from somewhere else, and who are at great risk themselves.
So now let's talk about the drug cartels, you know, the drug trade, which is the other layer of the environment here, you know, intersecting with the sex trade. There's a kind of other triangle here, the police, the cartels, and the sex trade. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best way to understand it is through, you know, or the best way that I understood it was through the stories of the women that the book follows. So there's one woman named Anna, that's a pseudonym, who was 26 when I met her, who had been working in the sex trade for about, you know, 10 to 12 years, and who was initially recruited by a pimp who housed her in essentially a closed house. So she was incarcerated in a house along with other girls, you know, underage girls, and they were essentially only let out to travel to cartel ranches, narco ranches, where they would be given to cartel members and essentially exploited. And Anna's description of the collusion between, you know, there was obviously the pimp who controlled her movements, sent her to these ranches, but also would allow the police a monthly, you know, essentially monthly access to the women. And by doing that, he ensured that he would never be the subject of police harassment. So that's just one way, sort of an informal way in which there's collusion between those, you know, servicing cartels and the police and involvement of the police in the sex trade. But there's much more formal ways I discovered. So as police officers that I interviewed themselves told me, you know, there's a number of different police in the city. And while the police are ostensibly, you know, out to end the cartels, and there are these major battles, like street fights where, you know, 17 people will end up killed in crossfire between police and cartels, in the red light district, everything is kind of different. Because in the red light district, first of all, the cartels, while not the sole proprietor or, you know, bosses of these large brothels, certainly have a stake in them. And in the red light district, instead of trying to end the cartels, the police are actually hired by these brothels. So essentially hired by the cartels to protect their investments. So you will have police, you know, municipal police that work a day job with the police who are out hunting the cartels, and then will be essentially what is called commercial police at night, where they are essentially rented or paid to protect the brothels themselves that are owned by the cartels.
And exploit the women who work in them.
Absolutely. So maintain the power structures by which women are kept vulnerable and, you know, kept in line. And Anna, the woman that I just described who told me about being recruited as a 14-year-old. She said that, you know, she thought about escaping from this closed house in which she was being kept, but she knew that if she escaped, because the police had these monthly visits, that if she escaped, she wouldn't get far, because it would be the police that would return her to the pimp.
Right. You know, there was something in this book, Dan, where in A City of Omens, where you advance a concept about how violence becomes self-sustaining. You say there's a critical mass of homicides beyond which violence becomes self-sustaining in a city like Tijuana. How does that work?
So I, you know, that was one of the most fascinating aspects of my work on this book, was understanding the kind of theories around that. And it's sort of a sad side effect of the massive levels of violence that have racked Mexico since a drug war was launched there against the cartels about 10 years ago, that there is this cottage industry of academics and experts expert thinkers thinking about violence and how it is self-sustaining, because it's just such a central feature of life there in so many places like Tijuana. There's a few different theories. So there's one theory that, you know, essentially violence in the drug trade is motivated by, you know, if you try to crack down on a cartel in power and you weaken them, the vacuum in the market that you create will entice other smaller cartels to initiate or to engage. So, you know, if a large cartel is the focus of a police or military action, that weakness or the weakening of that large cartel produces an opportunity for smaller cartels to take over some market share. So you essentially, by weakening the top cartel, you create a proliferation of cartels. And when you have more factions in play, you have more violence because there are more enemies and there's constant shifting alliances that produce violence. The other is that violence, if you try to destroy a market, you will send the players in that drug market fleeing to other locales. So it's not that they're being attracted by the violence, but that they're being repelled by it. But by them being repulsed into other settings, that puts them into conflict with the cartels or the players that were there before them. So that creates violence. Essentially, you know, there's an interesting analogy in the world of sort of addictions and drugs and drug policy. There's this thing called the balloon effect. And it was first described, or it was first used to describe what was happening in South America in the Andean region when, after there was a crackdown on Colombian production of cocaine, that suddenly there was cocaine production happening in all the countries surrounding Colombia. And it was described as the balloon effect because essentially, you know, if you picture a balloon inflated with air, if you poke your finger down on one part, sure, you poke down on that one part, but the air moves to other parts of the balloon. Other parts of the balloon inflate. And that's what happens when you try to engage with a totally unregulated and totally wild and chaotic market like the drug trafficking market.
You mentioned the war on drugs. This is where we kind of come full circle because you speak in the book in City of Omens about the Merida Initiative, which was something, you know, it's really the U.S./Mexican war on drugs. And you close the circle by saying that what is going on in Tijuana holds up a mirror to the United States, our part in driving this epidemic of femicide, in driving the violence around the drug and sex trades.
Absolutely. So, as I mentioned before, the only reason there's a sex trade in Tijuana in the first place is because there was a military base in San Diego. And Tijuana has, because it is so far away from sort of the center of Mexico, has done more to fashion itself into a city that can serve American needs and desires. And it is entirely, or has, or you know, historically, was an entirely U.S.-facing city. Like, in a way, Tijuana, the city, the people, understand American desires and the cost of those desires better than any American, because they have experienced, they have exploited them, they have served them. Now, the Merida Initiative is one of the huge geopolitical factors that put women at risk in Tijuana, kind of greater than any other phenomenon. As you describe, it's a Bush-era initiative. It is, you know, it can be seen as sort of like the same kind of nation-building, neo-conservative nation-building that President Bush and certainly Vice President Dick Cheney were trying to engage in with the invasion of Iraq, sort of democracy by military force. And this was applied to Mexico, where, yes, there was ostensibly a democracy, a very fragile one, but one that was threatened by the presence of drug cartels. And before the Merida Initiative, there was an ongoing system of understanding between Mexico's drug cartels and the ruling governing elite, which was basically the elite allowed the cartels to do their business, they taxed them informally, and in return, the cartels promised no violence. Now, that started to break down as U.S. involvement in Mexico increased. And that increase really, its zenith was the funding to the tune of, you know, somewhere between $1 and $2 billion of a military war against cartels in Mexico starting in 2009. And that war has done more to threaten the stability of the Mexican state. And again, this is not hyperbole than really anything that has come before. In some parts of Mexico, it resembles a civil war. And in Tijuana, the whole city has been racked by the violence. So as a result of the violence, the military decided, you know, it essentially the violence in Tijuana put a halt to the easy flow of American consumers of sex coming to Tijuana because they were scared of the violence. Now, it's a dark irony that that violence was funded by the United States. And by funding that violence, it kept Americans from being able to engage with their neighbors because of the violence. And that violence, because there was a reduction in the number of Americans visiting the red light district, did more to increase the desperation of women there than anything. And the book moves, just like epidemiology moves, from a close understanding of individual narratives to kind of this wide lens to understand these patterns across populations. So much of the stories, the narratives that I heard from women, and the broader trends that I documented across the population level can be traced back to this increase in the violence from the Merida Initiative.
Well, and that book, City of Omens, Dan Werb, A Search for the Missing Women of the Borderlands, is just fascinating, highly original, beautifully written. Thank you so much for a fascinating conversation about your book.
Thank you so much, Francesca. I appreciate it.
Dan Werb is an assistant professor in epidemiology at the University of California, San Diego, and the University of Toronto. His book, City of Omens, is out from Bloomsbury Press. The global strike for the climate is happening on September 20th. It's the start of a week of climate action in the run-up to the United Nations Climate Action Summit in New York City. Next week, we plan to talk with climate journalist and author Mark Hertzgaard about a new climate reporting initiative he's spearheaded. It's brought together more than 250 news outlets and media organizations to boost reporting on the climate emergency. But in the minutes we have left on this broadcast, we have some tape of an interview with world-renowned climate scientist Michael Mann, kindly given to us by two activists with the international initiative called Project Drawdown. Project Drawdown has identified 100 strategies to get the world carbon emissions free that ordinary people can do, both individually and collectively. Dorothy Riley and Cray Van Sickle of Drawdown East End spoke with Michael Mann when he came to East Hampton, New York in August to speak on a panel with youth climate activists about the urgency of the climate crisis. Cray Van Sickle started out the interview with this question.
According to a recent Yale study, outside of the climate deniers, 70% of the population are either alarmed, concerned, or cautious about climate change. How do you suggest Drawdown East End trigger those people to engage in opportunities to reduce greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, thanks. It's great to be with both of you. It's a good question. You know, how do we actually sort of move people in the direction that's necessary to tackle this monumental problem, climate change, and our efforts to avert catastrophic climate change? It requires dramatic and immediate action. We don't really have time to spare at this point. And so communicating the immediacy, the urgency of action is critical. And I think that Project Drawdown, both the sort of the larger national effort and the effort here, are ideally positioned to do that, because it's really about solutions. It's about things that people can do in their everyday lives that make a difference. And ultimately, you know, to conquer this, you know, problem, we're going to need both personal action and we're going to need collective action and policy if we're going to shift as dramatically as we need to away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. If we're to get off carbon as quickly as we can, we're going to need incentives. We're going to need economic and policy incentives. But we also need individual people to do everything they can. There's a whole lot of low-hanging fruit, lots of things that we can do in our everyday lives, you know, that save us money, they make us healthier, they make us happier and feel better, and they decrease our environmental footprint and our carbon footprint. And we all ought to be doing those things. And Project Drawdown, you know, has done a great job in sort of communicating to people what those things are, whether it's recycling or shifting your energy to wind and solar, or decreasing waste, greater energy efficiency. There are all these things that we can do. And these sort of voluntary things alone aren't going to be enough to solve the problem. We do need policy incentives, but they make a difference. And moreover, when people actually start doing things and engaging on this issue, that often leads them down a path of greater and greater involvement, where they realize that in addition to doing things themselves, they can help communicate to their community, to society at large, the things that we have to do. They can put pressure on their local policymakers and national politicians to act on this problem, to represent the interests of the people they're supposed to be representing, rather than the fossil fuel interests who too often fund their campaigns.
Drawdown East End's Dorothy Riley asked Michael Mann about the impact of the youth climate movement, including Sweden's Greta Thunberg and New York's Alexandria Villaseñor.
I think that the youth climate movement has been a real game changer when it comes to the larger conversation about climate change. You know, we've known about this problem for decades. Scientists have been warning the public and policymakers about this problem for decades, and yet we haven't seen the sort of action that's necessary to avert truly catastrophic climate change impacts. But we have seen this rising tide. We've seen children across the world, the famous Greta Thunberg in Europe, and here in the U.S., others like Alexandria Villaseñor, these children's, what they've called the Fridays for Future, where children on Fridays have been striking, you know, from school to raise awareness about what they see as an existential threat to their lives, to our future. And what they see as sort of an abdication of responsibility among the adults in the world, in particular elites, power brokers, politicians, who have failed to act in a way that is necessary to preserve this planet for our children and grandchildren. And so when we hear our children speak out about this problem, you know, none but the most jaded ears can fail to respond to the message, because it comes from the heart. These kids speak with a moral imperative and a moral authority that cuts through, in my view, the sort of morass of the often cacophonous, you know, climate conversation to the heart of the matter, which is we have to act. We have to do it now, and we need the adults, we need the power brokers, the politicians, the policymakers to act, because these kids can't vote. They can't have a direct role in policymaking. They can't be elected to higher office. And yet they are the ones who will be most impacted if we fail to act now. And so it's incumbent upon us, the adults, to respond to this exhortation by the youth here in the U.S., in Europe, and across the world to act now while we still can, while we still can avert catastrophic climate change. We don't have much time left. The numbers are unforgiving if you crunch them. We need to bring our carbon emissions down by a factor of two over basically the next decade if we are to get on a path that limits warming to what could arguably be described as catastrophic warming, more than a degree and a half Celsius warming of the planet. If we allow that to happen, we will see massive inundation of coastal cities, even more extreme and devastating wildfires and floods and heat waves and extreme weather events like we've seen in recent summers. The toll both on our economy and in terms of human life will, you know, grow to unacceptable levels if we fail to act now.
That was climate scientist Michael Mann talking this August with Craven Sickle and Dorothy Riley, both activists with the East End New York chapter of Project Drawdown. Go to drawdown.org to find out more. And go to writersvoice.net to hear the entire interview with Michael Mann. Also, Global Climate Week is happening from September 20th to September 27th. Go to globalclimatestrike.net for more information on how you can get involved. Next week, we talk with naturalist, wildlife filmmaker, and author Paul Rosalie about his first novel, based on a true story. It's called The Girl and the Tiger. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.